The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.
This week's episode of A Cast of Kings is brought to you by Hover.com. When you have a great idea and you want to secure a great domain name for it, you want to find the perfect name that represents your project, something that's catchy, memorable, and feels good typing on the keyboard and saying out loud. Hover.com makes it easy for you to find that domain name so you can get started actually working on your great idea. And today, Joanna, our promo code is hover.com/pointy. That's hover.com/pointy. You get 10% off your first purchase by going to hover.com/pointy. And your promo code will automatically be activated. That's because this week's episode is entitled The Pointy End. Now, this is obviously in reference to Needle, Arya's sword, when I think it was John that said to her, make sure you stick them with a pointy end, right?
Correct, yes.
Any other thoughts as to why this episode might have been called The Pointy End?
You know, I guess there's that, and there's the fact that Khal Drogo gets
he gets stuck with a sharp end,
yes,
of something,
a rounded edge,
a rounded edge of a blade, correct?
Right. You know, John hacks at a white, I guess, and then Sir Barristan throws his sword on the ground. So there's a couple weapons.
Yeah, I would also say
And Cirio, right?
Exactly, Cirio, yeah. Pharrell and his maybe final.
Maybe last stand.
Perhaps.
We don't know.
They all have pointy ends going on there. And yeah, we already talked about Arya, but she kills someone for the first time.
She sure does.
That's how she gets the bloodlust for this this series. But this is her first episode killing someone with Needle itself. So a lot of reasons why they might want to name this one the pointy end. And if you go to hover.com/pointy, you'll get 10% off your first purchase. Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Game of Thrones. I'm David Chen.
I'm Joanna Robinson.
And together we are reading Book 1 in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire, entitled A Game of Thrones. We're also watching the TV show along with our book reread. And this week we watched through Season 1, Episode 8, The Pointy End. And if you're just tuning in for the first time, you can find more episodes of this show at GameOfThronesPodcast.com. Email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. Find us also on Facebook at facebook.com/acastofkings, where you can comment on our episodes. What we're going to do today is talk about Season 1, Episode 8 of the show and the accompanying book chapters in Book 1 of A Song of Ice and Fire. We will not be spoiling anything that hasn't happened in the show, Game of Thrones, but we will spoil stuff that has happened in the books up to this point in the show. So I think that's a solid explanation of the very convoluted path we're taking on the podcast, Jonah.
I think you nailed it.
I keep trying to do it every week, and it never gets easier. I'm always worried if I'm going to get it wrong somehow. Anyway, so this week we're going to be talking about Season 1, Episode 8, The Pointy End, directed by Daniel Minahan, and written by Benioff Weiss and George R. R. Martin.
This is the first episode that he has a writing credit on, and he has one writing credit from season 1 through 4. He didn't write an episode in season 5. So it's rare to see a George R. R. Martin writing credit.
Right.
So
it gives it some kind of like legitimization, you know, to some degree.
Yeah, I think his episodes tend to be more faithful than some of the other, or you know, maybe right. to a fault or whatever, but you tend to see a lot of the dialogue directly lifted in his episodes, and maybe that's why. I mean, he said he didn't write an episode for season 5 because he was too busy writing his book. But maybe it's also that season 5 is so off book that he's like, I don't know how to adapt this. This isn't my story. What the hell?
Right. Yeah.
Anyway.
So we'll see if he has a writing credit in season 6 then. That'll be a good test.
A good test.
I will say, though, that in public, he has been distancing himself from the show pretty mm-hmm. significantly.
Yep.
There was... You know, mostly when it regards rape, I would say. there was the Jamie Cersei...
Yeah.
Sept scene last season, and then this season the Sansa storyline. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's just like, listen, man, this isn't my story.
Exactly. That's what he's saying. So, yeah, we'll see whether he writes an episode in the new season. Anyway, firstly, before we begin today, I'm just grateful for all the people that have stuck with us on this journey, not only through the podcast, but through this rewatch. Also grateful for all the sponsors that made this possible. But one of the disadvantages of doing it the way we're doing it is that we haven't incorporated as much feedback and follow-up into this season as we would have liked. And that's because we're incredibly busy, and so we wanted to record these episodes in advance to make sure we could release them on a rigorous schedule. Because not only do you need to watch the show, you need to read the book as well. So it multiplies the amount of time that you need to spend prepping for each episode. And I just wanted to make sure we had enough buffer. We are rapidly running out of buffer. And by the end, we're going to have no buffer. We're going to be recording in real time pretty much. So everything worked out as planned. And the feedback is finally starting to catch up to us. You can always email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. Comment at facebook.com/acastofkings. This came a couple of weeks ago, but Dina H., please let us know where you're from when you write in to acastofkings@gmail.com. But Dina H. wrote in a recent episode, quote, you discussed Sir Hugh and John Aaron. I have had a sneaking suspicion that George R. R. Martin wrote book one with the intention of John Aaron's murderer being Cersei, or someone Cersei had kill him, and that he only devised the Lysa murder John Aaron plot twist much later in the development of the story. There are clear clues that Sir Gregor was put up against Sir Hugh in the tourney to silence him and eliminate him, implying Cersei had him slip the poison to Jon Arryn. He had the access to Jon Arryn and seemed to be rewarded for it by an immediate and seemingly unearned promotion to knight. If Cersei wasn't responsible for Jon Arryn's murder, why was Sir Hugh made a knight? What other possible explanation is there? Additionally, when Kat arrives at the Eyrie with Tyrion in tow, Lysa displays genuine terror at having a Lannister in her and her son's presence. We know beyond a doubt Lysa is insane, but we do not know her to be a great actress. I think her behavior when Tyrion is brought to the Eyrie is that of someone who genuinely fears the Lannisters because she's convinced they killed her husband. At this point, in my opinion, Martin was still writing the narrative without intending Lysa to be Jon's killer. It is my opinion Martin later had a change of heart, or maybe just all of a sudden thought it would be a great twist to reveal that Lysa had killed Jon Arryn at the behest of Littlefinger. The book reveal, and this is not a spoiler because it happened in the show, was certainly shocking and made for a great moment, but was not in any way foreshadowed. Martin tends to foreshadow these big reveals, sometimes in ways so subtle you don't pick up on them until a reread when you already know what is to come. So for these reasons, I think the Lysa twist was invented after book one was written and does not totally jive with earlier storylines. The short version of the three reasons. Number one, book one makes fairly clear Sir Hugh killed Jon Arryn at the Lannister's urging. Point two, the fact that there is no indication it might have been Lysa until the big reveal next to the moon door. Point three, the fact that Lysa displayed genuine fear at the sight of Tyrion Lannister when poor Catelyn brought him there. Thanks and love the podcast. End quote. So John Robinson, what do you think of this theory that this is kind of a retcon that George R. R. Martin pulled by having Lysa be the murderer of John Arryn as opposed to Cersei putting Sir Hugh up for it?
I will say I agree with a couple things, and I agree that it's entirely possible. You know, particularly in this week's episode, we saw a scene with Lysa where I was trying to watch it, having in mind her being John Arryn's murderer, and whatever motivation she would have for not helping Kat would be out of loyalty to Littlefinger, I guess, then, and not out of fear of the Lannisters or whatever excuse that she gave. But I'm not sure I agree with the assessment of Sir Hugh, because you could still have Cersei promote Sir Hugh and Cersei manipulate Sir Hugh into dying just because she is afraid or certain that he knows what John Arryn knew.
Right.
Even if she had nothing to do with his death, if Sir Hugh, who was John Arryn's squire, was in his company all the time, he would maybe know that John Arryn was wise to what was going on with Cersei, and so she wanted him silenced either by bribery of promotion or death.
Right.
So I think Cersei, you know, could have engineered all this stuff with Sir Hugh without him being, like, her cat's paw or whatever. But I could also see the Lysa thing being a retcon. I think both of those things could be true.
The one thing I recall from the book that is not in the show is this brief mention, and I mentioned it on the podcast, of how John Arryn was thinking of removing Robin from Lysa's care.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? And it's just a throwaway reference. And the way it is done as a throwaway reference almost makes it feel like it's intended to be foreshadowing.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
And so that might have spurred Lysa on to murder John Arryn because no one's going to take away her boy. A sentiment that we witnessed again in the book reading this week, right?
Yes.
So that's another mark against Dina's theory. But yeah, I do find that Dina's sort of thinking in general is fairly attractive just because, you know, as we've discussed on this podcast, certain actions that characters take end up not making much sense later on, you know, when you know kind of where they're coming from. The most obvious one leaping to mind is, what is Varys doing this whole time? Why isn't he doing more to advantage, you know, Daenerys, say, at this early stage in the game? Did he intentionally cause that assassin to be caught? You know, there's a lot of unanswered questions, I feel, there. So anyway, nice try, Dina, but I think, you know, it's plausible that Lysa actually was the murderer of John Arryn, right? I think we're saying it's at the very least plausible.
Right.
So but yeah, keep those emails coming in to acastofkings@gmail.com. And we love to read that stuff. So let's move on into this week's episode. And again, we are discussing Season 1, Episode 8, The Pointy End. This episode begins with Sirio and Arya practicing. And it's happening while the Stark men are being slaughtered in the throne room. Ned Stark is being taken prisoner. And so that one event kind of then trickles down throughout the Red Keep and of course, throughout the rest of the kingdom as well. So this is a great scene. Cyril Farrell defends Arya against Lannister's men, and Meryn Trant tries to take Arya. Cyril is able to beat them with a wooden sword, which is pretty impressive, given that they are all wearing armor and have much more sophisticated weaponry. Anything you want to point out about this scene, Joanna?
I don't understand. This happens in the book, too. I don't understand why when Sirio knocks one of those men down, he doesn't take their actual sword.
Yes!
Like, I mean, he does so well with a wooden sword, and there's actually one move he has where one of the men, I think, is going after Arya while he's fighting off two of the others, and he just grabs his cloak and basically, like, holds him behind him while he's dispatching other men so that guy can't get to Arya. It's great. Great moves. But I'm like, but grab one of their swords so you have that. Because when Meryn Trant, you know, hacks his wooden sword in half, it's so so upsetting because Sirio is the better swordsman and he should win. And he would have, I think. I mean, he still might have. We really don't know what happened, but he definitely would have, I think, if he had picked up one of those swords.
We spoke last week about how Game of Thrones is a show that avoids convention, right? That in a quote-unquote normal show where you have all these plot threads of Ned writing down his one true heir and all these other threads that the show introduces, that you'd expect to see that paid off in some way, and often not only does the show not pay it off, it will just kill those characters, right? And so we've never seen a situation where that character that you thought was dead actually isn't dead. I don't think we have seen that, right? Where the show clearly led you to believe they were dead, and then they weren't dead. I'm probably wrong about that. Email in at a cast of kings.
Don't email, guys. I think we just leave this one on the ground.
All right, fair enough. So I guess, do you think Ciro Forel is still alive?
I do. I really do. I hope he is. I am of the opinion that if you don't see the body hit the floor, I consider that character alive until
really
on the eighth floor. Yeah,
very optimistic. So, do you also consider Benjen alive then?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Mm. All right.
I believe, and I think it's sloppy storytelling to leave that a question mark. Maybe it's not sloppy storytelling. Maybe it's sophisticated. Maybe it's like, ooh, we'll never know what happened to Benjen Stark. But I mean, someone should drag his corpse back to the wall so I can have some closure at some point. I think.
I do wonder if George R. R. Martin has these people's fates figured out, or if he just left those threads open because he's like, hey, this is dramatic material I might want to mine later on.
Oh, you know, I mean? And then all of a sudden Benjen comes like marching back and he's like, yeah, well, like I thought he was going to appear
right
in this last season. Anyway, I really, really did think he was going to. I do believe the Septa is dead, though. We didn't see her fall, but I think the showrunners have confirmed that Septa Mordaine dies sort of trying to protect Sansa in this same setup.
That is a shame. In the books, there's also mention of the fate of Jean Poole. I just feel like Jean Poole got the royal shaft in the show, right? Like, she's not even a character, although she is referenced a couple of times.
Right, but she becomes very important in the books.
Yeah. That's just like a whole plot thread that is completely unexplored in the show. Anyway, so we'll see if Ciro Forel comes back. I would love for him to. I suspect that he's not coming back. But like, if we got to the end of Game of Thrones, the show, and he didn't come back, you just, in your mind, he would still be alive, right?
Yeah. I mean, there are some theories. Listen, I feel fine saying these theories because there's no there's no evidence,
right.
So it doesn't matter.
Right.
There's some theories because he's a Bravosi that Ciro Forel is a faceless man, like Jaqen H'ghar.
Yep.
So that maybe we have already seen him again, but he was wearing a different face. And I think there's just suspicions of like why the first sort of Braavos would be training a little girl in King's Landing, unless like it was part of the whole thing that the faceless men consider Arya important somehow.
Fascinating. You know? All right, yeah.
That's a totally unfounded theory that, it's just floating around there.
It is not supported by any text whatsoever.
Right, right.
But it's not completely implausible.
Our hearts and our wishes want it to be true. And I will say watching this scene, it's satisfying to know that Arya is going to murder the shit out of Meryn Trant in like 4 seasons, right?
Right.
So
in brutal fashion.
That's how I feel. Like seeing Janice Lint and seeing Meryn Trant, I'm like, the Starks are going to get you guys.
Right.
Eventually. Just you wait.
Arya goes to the stables and this stable boy finds her.
Yeah.
And she says, let me go. And she finds a sword and she stabs him with it and then runs away. Okay, now in your mind, is the stable boy still alive?
No, he's dead.
He's dead. The death was much more graphic in the book.
And also more intentional, I think. Like in this, it seems like Arya sort of
turned
around and oops, right. There's a stable boy and he's like shish kebab. But in the books, like this is where the Chatterley episode comes from. Arya says, like, she forgot all of her training that Cyro Forel gave her, and all she could remember was what Jon told her to do, which is stick him with the pointy end. And so she does. And I mean, he was going to take her to Cersei, so she definitely was right in defending herself. Whether she needed to, like, deal a mortal blow in defending herself is dubious, but she's a kid, and, you know.
Let me ask you this. What do you think is a more interesting way of depicting that character? Like, it being a more intentional fatal blow, or it kind of being almost an accident like it happens in the show? I would argue the book way, you know, because we know that she becomes a killer later on. So
exactly,
I guess,
yeah.
I kind of wanted this to be her first taste of blood.
Yeah.
And then kind of that leading her down the path to, like, oh, she killed this kid and maybe she kind of liked it, you know? And then that would make kind of this bigger arc for her, like her descent into darkness, that I think would be pretty compelling. Not to say it isn't already compelling, but that is what stuck out to me watching the scene. Is like, oh, well, she just almost accidentally killed this person. Why even have that happen then? You know, like, why is that even important if there's not some kind of intentionality behind it?
I agree. There should be intention.
Yeah. Otherwise, he could just be injured. Do you know what I mean?
Right. So,
the Hound has an encounter with Sansa, mm-hmm. where he takes her hostage, and we know it's not the last time that he will have encounters with Sansa. and then, the Stark children are under control, or at least Sansa is under control, I should say. Arya is kind of out on her own. And Ned is in the dungeon.
We can talk a little bit more, I guess, about Sansa. We'll talk about that in her later scene, I think.
Yes, exactly. Okay. So Varys comes in, kind of helps him out.
What about my daughters?
The younger one seems to have escaped the castle. Even my little birds cannot find her.
And Sansa?
Still engaged to Joffrey. Cersei will keep her close. The rest of your household, though, all dead, it grieves me to say. I do so hate the sight of blood.
You watched my men being slaughtered and did nothing.
And would again, my lord. I was unarmed, unarmored, and surrounded by Lannister swords. When you look at me, do you see a hero?
And I really like this scene because it really gives a sense of what Varys is really up to. You know, you kind of get a sense of the fact that Varys understands his place in the order of things, right? When Ned accuses him of just standing idly by while his men were slaughtered, Varys retorts, and I would do that again, because do I look like a hero to you? I know my place. I'm just doing what I'm supposed to do.
And then, he was, like, unarmed and outnumbered. What would be the point?
Right.
Taking a stand there. He would do no good there, but he might be able to do good in the long run.
Right, and it's a great clash between Varys' pragmatism and Ned's nobility and idealism, right?
Right.
It just laid out bare as like, hey, what we just did, you know, last episode, that's a great demonstration of who we are. So I really like that. Anything else you want to mention about this Varys-Ned scene?
Well, one is that Varys in the books is like this master of disguise.
Uh-huh.
And not so much in the show. Like, in the books, it's like he came completely unrecognizable, and in here he just, like, has a hood on. and then also, you know, there's this whole thing of Ned not feeling like he's in the worst position on the chessboard because he thinks that Catelyn still has Tyrion. And then Varys says, yeah, your wife let Tyrion go. And he's like, well, slit my throat now and be done with it. Like, I'm screwed. We have no plays left. And in the book, it's even worse, I think, because Varys makes it clear that Sansa is a vulnerable player. You know, Cersei has Sansa, right? And so it's Sansa's life, which the show will make more obvious later. But it's Sansa who, like, is in danger of having her throat slit at any moment if Ned doesn't do whatever they ask him to do.
Right. Right. Yeah. Good stuff. Good characterization, and yeah, the hope, like, Ned just, like, loses all hope when he hears that that Catelyn has let Tyrion go. It's quite a powerful moment.
And I mean, he's in the Black Cells, which I think is where. Please write in, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's where Margaery and Cersei are supposed to be in this season. It looks very different, right? But it still looks very sad. Ned is just, you know, he's got an injured leg. It's just like sitting on the ground against the wall. And this is a Lord of Winterfell. And look how like screwed and sad he is. So, yeah. I mean, it's about to get worse, but still.
he's about to become much less comfortable yes. in his stay at King's Landing.
Yes, yes.
So the only thing I wanted to mention is Varys says, hey, like, hang on to this and hide it because men have been known to die of thirst in these cells. I just got to say, dude, really? They would be that careless with, you know, they, like, the whole point of keeping him there is to keep him alive. They would just let him die. All I'm saying is the prison system at King's Landing really needs some reform. So that's my takeaway from that.
Okay.
Anyway, so what else goes on? Let's talk about all the stuff that happens at the wall this week. Not that much stuff, but there's a few scenes. Firstly, last episode we saw Jon's direwolf bring a severed hand to the Night's Watchmen, and this week they find the bodies attached to them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of identify them, and they said, "Oh, they should be burned."
Jon says
they should be burned. In the book, it's kind of more ambiguous who says it,
right?
And I like how in the show notes you write Mormons wanted Aemon to examine them first. I think you meant to say Mormont.
There's a lot of typos in the show notes because I took them on my iPad this week. So
very impressive.
There's a lot of autocorrect going on. All the names are like hilariously autocorrected. Anyway, Mormons and Mormont wanted Aemon to examine them first. So they bring the bodies inside the castle. Like they're already looking at them going, these guys might be zombies. But let's bring them inside the castle. That's a good plan. Let's do that.
Well, I think in the book, it is clear that they are zombies. Like, they have the blue eyes.
Right.
I don't think they had the blue eyes in the show, from what I recall.
I feel like their eyes were closed. But yeah. I love that part of the book when they're like, and as far as I remember, he didn't have blue eyes when he was alive.
Right.
I don't know. It's very horror show. Like,
huh.
The call is coming from inside the house.
Yeah, you think that might have been a good sign, indication? Anyway, so what else happens at the wall?
Well, Mormont tells Jon about Ned in like the next scene.
Right, and Alistair mocks Jon, and Jon just goes after him, right?
Alistair's such a dick. I mean, I think I forgot, you know, because in between season one, you've got like, two seasons, season and a half of Jon being separated from the wall, right? Two seasons. So I sometimes forget how much of a dick Alistair was to Jon in season one and why he has so much cause to hate him when he gets back.
Right. And one of the things, and again, I don't want to sound like a broken record, but one of the things that this season one rewatch has really given us an appreciation of, I feel, is how well these plot threads were seeded in this first season. Like you said, Meryn Trant and Janna Slynt, we see how their treachery plays out this season, and that makes their death later all the more satisfying. And then also the conflicts between Alistair and Jon. Like they have a very toxic relationship this season. I would argue it's even more toxic in the book. And it makes Alistair's eventual betrayal of Jon even more understandable. So, yeah, I think it's some great character work here. And agreed, he's a complete dick here. So Jon goes after him, and then
I mean, who says not only a bastard, but a bastard of a traitor? I mean, how evil do you have to be to kick this kid when he's down? Okay, anyway. Alistair, not my favorite person.
Fair enough. that's fair. I mean, okay, let me ask you this question, John Robinson. what is it? Marry, have sex with, kill, Alistair, Jon Snow, Ollie.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Alistair, Meryn Trant, or Janna Slynt. Okay, so I got to... Oh, God. Oh, gross.
Yep.
This is a bad option. I mean, clearly I have to murder Ollie. Like, there's no other choice. Ollie must die. Though I guess I should have said fuck Ollie, too. Like, but that's gross. But anyway, to be in line with the Reddit thread.
Correct.
Anyway, murder Ollie, have disgusting sex with Alistair Thorne, and marry Jon Snow.
Okay. All right. Good. Good.
Have,
good.
have disgusting hate sex.
That is the correct answer. That is the correct answer, Joanna. So John gets confined to quarters, and then, you know, his direwolf starts freaking out, and then this is not a White Walker, right?
Right, it's a white, which is W-I-G-H-T, or,
So it convey the difference between the white and the White Walker?
So the white are any of the people who are humans, die, and then become like a thrall to the White Walkers. The White Walkers are the ones who are like icy, you know, they look different. The White Walkers, we don't necessarily know their origin, but they may never have been human, whereas they probably were human a million years ago. But the point is, the whites, the thralls, the zombies, are just like, you know, slaves. It's like, what is it? In Dracula.
Yeah, or I was just going to say Body Snatchers, Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Yeah, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Yeah. But it's, what's that character in Dracula? It's not Renly. Anyway, that's what I always think of when I think of a thrall. Dracula would have these like thralls, these people who are like under his spell and his command and stuff like that. So,
right. So then, John, I think, stabs this guy right through this white and does nothing. It's only when he throws fire on him that he's able to incapacitate this guy.
Right.
And he saves Norman's life.
Yes.
And so that's pretty good.
It's Renfield. Renfield is a thrall to Dracula. Okay, anyway. This isn't in the book, but Alistair's like, you'll hang for this to John for, like, attacking him. So there's a real question when you're watching the show. It was like, is John, like, I mean, maybe not hang, but I don't know. He can't get kicked out of the Night's Watch, can you? I don't know. Is there anything worse than being in the Night's Watch? but then he's like he's in real trouble for what he did. And then he saves the commander. And so he's back in good graces again. But yeah, he saves the commander. He grabs the lantern and throws it, catching this thing on fire. I have a question for you. Have you ever heard of any theories about people being secret Targaryens?
No.
Okay, so there's theories about, like, basically every character in the book being a secret Targaryen. I've read them about every single character, basically. And Jon's one of them. And people take it as evidence that he grabbed this lantern and got burned by it, that he's not a secret Targaryen.
Hmm.
Do you know? He burned his hand. So people are like, he's probably not a Targaryen.
Right. Not even a theory that occurred to me at the time, but good to know that.
I'm just saying it applies to, like, people want Targaryens popping up all over the place, and I don't know that anyone's a secret Targaryen, but yeah.
Fair enough. I did find one element in the book that wasn't in the show, I don't think, which is that Mormont makes reference to Ser Jorah in the book reading. And I did feel as though if there had been more of a connection there, you have enough. It's when Jorah finds out about Mormont's eventual death in the most recent season of Game of Thrones, it is a very powerful moment. But I think the book did do a better job of reinforcing those connections between the characters. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but yeah. I feel Commander Mormont talks about his son in the show.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
But it just, I don't know. It feels like they did maybe a tiny bit more character work there in the book, although that could just be my imagination. Anyway, so then they burn the corpses, and Sam gets to have like a smart moment, right, where he's saying, that's not regular blood, you know? He kind of identifies what makes these whites different than just, you know.
Yes.
Regular people, I guess.
And I believe Commander Mormont's like, you may be fat, but you're not dumb. It's like, okay.
Yes. Well, good stuff. So
that's his compliment for Sam.
Anyway, they destroy these whites in this massive, beautiful fire.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what I would like to destroy in a huge fire, John Robinson?
Goodness, what?
Most domain name registers.
Oh.
Because they are very challenging to use.
Yes.
But fortunately, there is one that isn't a hassle, And that's really? hover.com.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, hover.com/pointy, which is this week's promo code, gets you 10% off your first purchase. But yeah, hover.com takes all the hassle and confusion out of buying and managing a domain. In less than 5 minutes, you can find the domain name you want and get it up and running. And the website has a super clean and simple interface, so you don't have to mess around with complex stuff. Best of all, they don't upsell you on a bunch of crap that you don't need. They are super smart. They spend a lot of time figuring out what are the essentials of what people need when they go to buy a domain name. They're like the Samuel Tarly of domain name registrars, right? In the sense that they are really good at one thing, which is registering domains.
Yes.
And they also have lots of great extensions like .pizza, which I'm also sure Sam would appreciate. So,
who doesn't appreciate .pizza?
I agree. I think I don't have enough .pizza domain name extensions. I feel like I need to load up on .pizza.
I feel like next season it should be CastleKings.pizza.
I mean, we should not even next season. We should just make that happen by the end of this season. In fact, I'm going to make that happen.
Okay.
Unilaterally. So, CastofKings.pizza and other domain names can be found at hover.com using promo code pointy. So go to hover.com/pointy and you can get a lot of domain names, get them for free. And again, you can check out really, really quickly. Not only that, if you need a hand, hover.com has the best customer support around. They are known for their no wait, no hold, no transfer phone service. So when you call, a real live human being is ready to help. So it sounds like you get a lot with any purchase at hover.com. And again, use hover.com/pointy to get 10% off your first purchase. And we'd encourage you to use that service. If you have any ideas, if you have any concepts in your head just clattering around that you want to bring into the real world, hover.com/pointy. Great way to make that happen. So let's get back to the episode, Joanna. This week, a lot of other stuff happened. Let's start back at King's Landing. Basically, Cersei and her hench people manipulate Sansa into doing their bidding, right? They have a talk with her and they say, hey, you should write a letter to your family telling them not to freak out about what's happened, because I think they're just trying to, you know, control the situation, right?
Yeah, and also just by indicating, you know, nobody is fooled whenever someone sees these letters that Sansa write, they're like, yeah, Sansa wrote it with her hand, but it's the queen's voice. And it's basically the queen saying, I've got Sansa. Don't be dumb. Right. I've got Sansa, and I can make her do whatever I want. So don't be dumb. Come bend the knee.
Little dove, you must write to Lady Catelyn. And your brother, the eldest, what's his name?
Rob.
Word of your father's arrest will reach him soon, no doubt. Best it comes from you. If you would help your father, urge your brother to keep the king's peace. Tell him to come to King's Landing and swear his fealty to Joffrey.
If I could see my father, talk to him about...
You disappoint me, child. We've told you of your father's treason. Why would you want to speak to a traitor?
I only meant that... What will happen to him?
That depends.
On what?
On your brother. And on you.
What's weird about this scene, so it's Pycelle, Varys, and Littlefinger, and the book does this great and creepy thing with Littlefinger that I think the show really missed the opportunity to plant the seed for his, like, creepy obsession with Sansa. Because in the book, he keeps saying, like, she looks more like her mother than she does like her father, and, like, all, you know, and he just keeps talking about her, and it's quite creepy. And I feel like in the show, it's just, like, Pycelle and Varys and Littlefinger all presented this united, like, your father was a traitor, you've got traitor blood in you, it's so sad that your father's a traitor, but he is, write this letter, you know?
Yeah.
There isn't as much nuance as I think there is in the book version. But and also Lena Headey like laying it on so thick with the warm smiles at right. Sansa in both this scene and then the later scene, just like it's not an expression we often see on Cersei's face. And I feel like even later when she does this sort of, or maybe Cersei just like ran out of fucks to give and stopped pretending to be nice to people, but like I think this is the nicest she's pretended to be to someone that she clearly doesn't care about, you know, in this episode.
Right, right. The book tells this story from the perspective of Sansa, and she is still deeply in love with Joffrey. She still thinks everything can be fixed. I think my favorite moment from this scene is when she says, well, can I talk to my dad? And, you know, Cersei is just so disappointed in that request.
You know? I'm not mad. I'm just disappointed.
Yeah, why would you want to talk to a traitor? Don't you understand that makes no sense? Of course, we as the viewers know that if they did talk, they could probably engineer a different outcome.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Oh, the other major thing, of course, is that in the books, they don't do this in the show, but in the books, Sansa had tipped Cersei off that Ned meant to like squirrel her and Arya away. So that meant that Cersei knew she had to move and take the girls right then or else they would be out of her grasp.
Right. So Sansa is almost like in some ways the architect of Ned's demise, right? Because of that
action. I feel like architect is too strong, but
you're right.
You know, certainly
proximate cause.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, part of it. Part of why it happened when it happened, maybe. Yeah. Because Cersei's like, okay, once again, to talk about the chessboard, like she sees these pieces that she needs, Arya and Sansa, moving out of her grasp. So she's like, okay, I have to move now. I have to take the kids. And you know, Varys and Ned talked about why didn't Ned move earlier? And he's like, well, because of her kids. And Cersei's got like the opposite approach where she's like, I'm going to go straight for his kids and they're going to be my power pieces, right. You know? Whereas Ned is like, I wanted her to give her an opportunity to take those kids away to safety.
Right, right. Different approaches, different outcomes, for sure.
For sure.
So, a lot of really interesting stuff in that scene. And then, of course, the letter gets to Winterfell via Raven. And Rob and Theon and Master Luwin, they read it, they discuss it. And Rob assembles his bannermen, and he's like, I gotta go do this thing. And then they, to get the bannermen, they release a whole cloud of ravens, probably all the ravens they have. Right?
It looks so good, doesn't it?
Looks pretty
all,
cool.
Like, first you just see all the ravens going by a window, but then you get a wide shot of Winterfell with just, yeah, as you say, clouds of ravens pouring out to go collect the bannermen. So.
Pretty awesome. And, of course, at the Eyrie, they also get word of it. And Kat asks for Lysa's allegiance, and Lysa won't give it to her, right?
Right.
And she's theoretically afraid of the Lannisters because of what they did to Jon Arryn. That's kind of one of her reasons for not participating in this. And probably a reason for Dina's email to us saying, hey, maybe Lysa didn't kill Jon Arryn. Why would she be afraid in this case? Although I think there is probably a legitimate explanation, right? She just doesn't want to be – she knows there's a lot of killing that's going to happen. A lot of conflict, and she just doesn't want to be involved, right?
I mean, I think we could extrapolate. Okay, so George R. R. Martin wrote this episode, right?
Mm-hmm.
And by the time, you know, season one came out, the book, you know, the book reveal that Lysa killed Jon Arryn had already happened. Like, that book had already been published, right? So George R. R. Martin wrote this episode knowing that Lysa's the one who killed Jon Arryn. So he could have taken the opportunity to write this scene to give us even more hints about, you know, whatever. He didn't, so this isn't a matter of retconning necessarily here. But so then the way that I would interpret it is Lysa would want to wait to hear what Littlefinger would want her to do.
Sure.
So she wouldn't want to mobilize the Knights of the Vale without knowing what Baelish would want to use them for. So right. She's like, we're just staying out of it.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. There's many logical explanations for why she'd want to stay out, other than fearing the Lannisters.
Right. Right?
So, anyway, moving on, Tyrion and Bronn are kind of chilling. They're getting to know each other a little bit, becoming buddies. And then they're attacked by the hill people.
Right.
Right. And Tyrion is able to talk his way out of being killed, which is pretty good.
Again.
And then he promises them lots of sword and weapons, and you can see from their perspective, hey, we could just not kill this one dude and his friend, potentially get a huge windfall from it. So they take him up on it, and fast forward to later on in the episode, they enter the Lannister camp, and you know they finally meet up with Tywin, where Tyrion learns the king is dead, Joffrey takes the throne, Cersei's probably in control, all this kind of stuff.
So this is where we meet Tywin in the books, I believe.
Right.
I guess as we mentioned, that scene with him and Jaime is the show invention. Someone did message me on Twitter saying, I thought the scene between Tywin and Jaime was a reference to something between Samwell and Randall Tarly, his father Randall Tarly. And it's true that in the reading for this week, when Sam is talking about the blood on the whites, he says it in reference to the fact that his father used to make him watch as he would like dress his kills. So, I mean, it is, you know, and the Tarly, you know, Sam's father is this like uncompromising, stern figure. So this uncompromising, stern father figure making his son watch as like sort of a power play as he like skins some game is something that happens in the book. But, you know, so that might be an inspiration for the Tywin Jaime scene, but it's not like a direct lift of that dynamic, you know?
Gotcha. Gotcha. Yeah. Some pretty memorable description of Tywin in the book. Like that his eyes were flecked with gold, which I don't think they wanted, what is it, Charles Dance, is that his name?
Yeah.
To wear contact lenses, and that would have been pretty distracting.
Yeah.
But yeah, a great conversation between them, and you kind of get a sense of the dynamic between them, you know, that Tywin is doing this because he has to, not because he really loves Tyrion that much. Tywin has a pretty dysfunctional relationship with all his children, come to think of it. But great relationship, and then they recruit the Hill people to join them in this battle, right?
Right. That Tyrion was like, hey, Hill people, escort me safely, and my father will give you, you know, booty, right, basically. Yeah. And then Tywin's like, yeah, I'll give you that, but you have to fight for me first. And they're like, well, cool, then Tyrion's our prisoner until then, and he has to fight with us. And Tywin's like, that's cool.
Yeah.
And Tyrion's
peace.
Like, God damn it. Also, it's worth noting that Kevin Lannister, Tywin's brother, is in this scene. And, of course, he came back to play in a big way in season 5. So, and for once, they didn't recast the actor. That's the same actor who came back and
played nice.
Kevin Lannister in season 5. So this is it's another character that they planted here to pick up later.
To clarify, by the way, they did promise him all that Tyrion promised them and more. So it wasn't just, hey, you need to do this additional thing. It was, hey, I'm going to give you even more things than you were promised. So.
Right, but he was kind of saying, like, but I'm not going to give you that first thing until you do this.
I did not take it that way.
Okay.
Yeah, I took it that, hey, if you quit now, you'll still get this stuff because Lannister always pays his debts. But you might not get all these other things that I could give you. So,
maybe.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't think we hear from the Hill people ever again. At least in the show, we don't, right?
We do, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they run into battle with him.
Like, no, I know. I mean, like, later on in later seasons, I mean.
Oh, yeah, no. It's just a season one thing. Yeah.
So I guess their function is just to kind of bring more, kind of fill in the rest of this world a little bit more, right?
Exactly.
Like, here's another element of Westeros, that there are these people just living in the hills, marauding, that aren't Dothraki.
That's true. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of Dothraki marauders, they do a lot of marauding, a lot of raping and pillaging this episode.
Yeah.
And, you know, Dany gets really upset about this, and she says, stop raping all these women, and that causes a lot of problems because raping is apparently part of their culture.
Well, and as Jorah pointed out, the reason they were marauding in the first place was to get, you know,
right,
goods to get a fleet together to go to Westeros, which is what she wanted. So the reason all this raping and pillaging is happening, well, the pillaging, the raping is just the Dothraki way, but like the pillaging is happening because she insisted that they go invade Westeros. So,
right. So she's all into it until, you know, this is classic Dany, Joanna. She's all into these brash moves until she sees the consequences.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah.
So in this case, anyway, it got someone really pissed off, and they want to fight Khal Drogo about it. So they do. And he gets his tongue ripped off. which is, I thought that was a pretty memorable fight scene.
I love, it's so sad though, because you're watching it and like Drogo just like leans into that cut.
Right.
It's just like, well, that's the cut that's going to kill you. I mean, it's not the cut that kills him, but still, it's like, brother, you know, yeah, watching someone lean into their eventual demise, it's pretty, pretty sad.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, Joanna, I think that scene is actually a metaphor for modern society's abuse of antibiotics.
Clearly.
I mean, we are heading towards a post-antibiotic future where a simple cut might kill you. You know, we must not allow this to happen.
Anyway. I mean, especially if there's a witch woman around with a vendetta against you.
Seriously. She did a really good job of hiding the fact that she hated everyone there, though.
I think she's great. That was great casting.
Right. For sure. So, yeah, she comes forward and says, oh, I can help. I can help. And it's like, oh, all right. Well, there you go. I'm sure that's going to work out well. This person who's village you just destroyed.
Right, but we're sitting there being like, oh yeah, she should be grateful to Danny. Danny stopped the raping. But I think later she's like, yeah, they already raped me 5 times before you got there. So you're the worst.
Yes, you don't even know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
All right, so what else goes on in this episode?
This is a big Rob episode. Like, we haven't seen much of Rob at all. Like, in the show, up until this point, when he basically takes on, you know, the Lord of Winterfell title, basically.
Yeah. Right? Fascinating also in the book, this is told from Bran's perspective.
Yeah.
Stuff. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, they invite a lot of bannermen to Winterfell, and mm-hmm. Jon tries to recruit them, and you get a sense of the dynamic between Rob and the Bannermen. It's not as though they're just, oh, hey, we're going to respect you unconditionally. Do you know? He has a lot to prove, right?
Right, especially because he's a kid. In the books, even more so a kid.
Yeah,
right?
Like how old is he in the books?
I feel like he's like 14 or 15. Right. Yeah. I think John's 14, so I think Rob's 15, something like that. Yeah.
I'm curious kind of what the show would have been like if they did get like a high schooler to play this role, right? Like, how would it have been different? Would it have been better? Would it have been worse?
I think you've gone back and forth on that before, because I think I've heard you say it both ways. It's sort of like, this would have been better if he had actually been a kid, or this would have been totally impossible if he had been a kid. I think some of John's stuff would have been better. I think he got a lot of criticism, especially in like season 2 and season 3, I think, for being kind of immature with some of his decisions.
Right.
But if you think of him as a 15-year-old, it makes a lot more sense. Sansa too. I think some people criticize Sansa unfairly. Or not unfairly, but just because her character is supposed to be much younger.
Right. And in this episode, you know, with Rob, if he was a teenager leading these armies into battle, I think the way it plays out in the show is completely plausible. If he had been a teenager, it would have been even more understandable why the Bannermen wouldn't all just rally around him immediately and why he'd have so much to prove.
Well, I mean, so they rally. It's not that I think they're there, and it's not that Rob needs to recruit them. They're already there to serve him. It's like they're arguing over who should like lead the charge,
right,
and who should do what. And, you know, and Catelyn says later when she joins Rob, like, you could have let Great John Umber or Rickard Cardstark or one of them actually lead this battle because you're a kid and you could have just hung out at home. And Rob's like, no, I couldn't. Come on now. But, you know, I think that's an implication. Not that they wouldn't go rescue Ned, but that maybe one of the seasoned warriors should do the leading. And, you know, so then Rob thankfully has a direwolf to prove his strength.
I just think Rob being an older gentleman with like a beard, very distinguished, makes him look plausibly like someone who could lead people into battle. Whereas when they are very dismissive of him, like Tywin and Tyrion are like, oh yeah, he's going to lose his hunger for battle right quick. You know, you can understand why they might say it. I think that would have been more satisfying reversal if, hey, this is just a teenager, but oh my gosh, he happens to be like Ender Wiggin level genius of leading people into battle. You know what I mean? That would have been an interesting dynamic to play with, which instead it's just like, oh, he's a skilled warrior. He's just like slightly younger than other warriors. Which yeah. is, you know what I mean? Like that, you would have added a whole different dynamic. I'm not sure it would have been better. I'm just saying.
Yeah. I think that in the show, right? Tywin says he's just a kid, whatever, and Tyrion's like, yeah, I don't know. He's kind of a belligerent kid. I wouldn't underestimate. Like Tyrion always has people's like the measure of people pretty well, you know. So he's right. like, yeah, I wouldn't count Robb Stark out, you know. So, but yeah, it's a great scene with the Grey Wind biting off two fingers, the great Jon Umber, and yeah,
a few other random events. We have Rickon. A great scene with Rickon where Bran says, "Hey, Robb is leaving," and he's like, "They're going to come back though," and Rickon says, "No, they're not." And he's
Rickon's right. Yeah.
He's right. Yep.
yeah. Bran's like, Rob's going to go and he's going to come back and bring mom and dad with him. And Rickon's like, nope. And we're all like, yeah, they're all going to die, bro.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then Bran goes to kind of pray. Asha's there. And then Hodor wanders onto the scene completely naked.
I'm well aware of this scene.
Because you've gotten scented many, many times.
Yeah.
What did you think was the purpose of this scene?
It's a segue. Well, two things. One, it's a good conversation about religion. Right. Later in like season two or three, we see Sansa praying at a godswood stump in King's Landing because Asha talks about how they cut down all the godswood in the south. So at a weirwood stump. So Sansa has to go to a stump to pray because she doesn't have like the trees that they have in Winterfell. So that's good. But then also like the whole giant thing, you know, the giant's blood is a segue into Asha talking about the giants north of the wall. She talks about the White Walkers and then she says that Robb is taking his swords the wrong way. He should be heading north to defend against what's coming. And she's right. She's just a couple season early, but she's right, you know?
So I think what we're saying is the male nudity is much more essential to the plot than any of the female nudity. Is that fair?
I don't know. I don't even want to talk about this.
I do remember, Joanna Robinson, back in the pre-season 5 days, when the White Walkers were just this thing that were constantly being alluded to and never paid off, and how different it was in a post, what is it?
Hardhome.
Post-Hardhome world where, man, you really get to see what danger these creatures pose to us or the characters in the show. So anyway, good stuff and some really crucial nudity there. What else goes on? Oh, yeah, so there's this really lovely scene with Kat and Robb. You know, Kat shows up and Rob's there and... In both the book and the show, you know, Kat wants to just like give him a hug, but she can't do that because he's a general now, or you know, he's a man's man. He can't be seen hugging his mom in front of everyone. So they send everyone away so she can give him a hug. I just thought that was a very nice moment.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, they kind of talk.
Did you notice who's missing from this and other scenes?
Tell me,
Roose Bolton.
Hmm.
Right? Roose Bolton is all up in this, like, assembling the Northern Bannermen scenes. But Roose Bolton, the character doesn't show up till season 2, episode 4. So, you know, we talked about how great it was that they seated in, like, Janice Lint, Meryn Trant, Alyssa Thorne, Kevin Lannister, but they did not take the opportunity to plant Roose Bolton right here. And they talk about him in the book. They talk about how...
Yeah, he's scared of Roose Bolton.
He's scary and, like... He's the one that Robb sends to treat with Tywin because he needs to send someone who's cunning and scary. Yep. And little does he know. You know, and then they're also talking, of course, about the Freys in this scene and how they need Walder Frey in order to cross at the Twins and, like, trap Jaime on one side of the river and Tywin on the other side of the river. And, you know, once again, this is like Khal Drogo leaning into the blade. It's like they're headed towards the Freys and Roose Bolton and their ultimate demise. So, yeah.
This scene also kind of establishes the stakes. You know, why is it that Robb is doing what he's doing? Catelyn Stark basically says, you need to meet them in the field. We can't do it any other way. We can't negotiate this. We need to defeat them in battle. And if you don't defeat them in battle, we will all die horribly, pretty much, right?
So. Yeah, and his sisters will die horribly.
Yep.
And nobody knows where Arya is.
Speaking of which, well, we can talk about that in a bit. But yeah, the whole Arya-Sansa dynamic. Other thing that happens this episode with Robb Stark is that they find a Lannister spy and Robb lets him go. What did you make of that?
There's not an exact... I mean, I really hope I'm not wrong here, but I don't think there's an exact corollary in the book. They do see find some Lannister scouts at some point, but my sense here is that Robb lets him go with the wrong information. He lets him go saying, tell Tywin Lannister that thousands of men are marching down the King's Road towards him, but what he means to do is break off and attack Jaime, split his forces and attack Jaime Lannister. So if Tywin marshals most of his forces in preparation on the King's Road, that means that Robb has a better chance of winning against Jaime over in the Riverlands.
Right.
And so everyone's watching being like, what are you doing letting him go? And I feel like Robb sort of tries to telegraph to his mom, like, no, I have a plan. And he gives this guy the wrong information.
Well, there's that great moment when she says, Robb. And then he gives her this look like, don't question me again, you know?
Or don't make it sound like I'm your child right now.
Right,
please.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. He
stopped short of going, Mom!
Come on, be a friend.
Yeah.
Anyway, good dynamic between the two of them.
Do you think that's accurate, that he let the guy go with wrong information?
I don't recall enough about future episodes to be able to definitively answer that right now.
Robb, what happens, right, is that Robb does beat Jaime because they take Jaime Lannister prisoner.
Right.
And they do have to cross the twins in order to make that happen. They have to treat with Walder Frey and all this sort of stuff. I've been rereading this battle and actually kind of like looking at the map to try to figure. It's complicated because at this point in the book, Tywin is supposed to be like marching north towards Harrenhal, which puts him. I don't know. I'm overthinking it. Anyway.
So basically we can conclude Robb either fed the misinformation or B is just trying to demonstrate mercy when most people wouldn't. Those are the only two explanations.
Yeah, right? I think it's misinformation.
Yes, that sounds very, very plausible to me. So
please do write in at castofkings@gmail.com to let me know how wrong I am about. Please do. With map screenshots and...
But yeah, I think, well, you know, to be fair, John, I think you're being genuine this time, right? Like, I think we do actually want to know that information, right?
Well, I mean, on the one hand, yes. But on the other hand, like, I feel like I get the gist. I'm sure, like, it's not that George R. R. Martin made any kind of error. But what I'm saying is, like, looking at the maps is a little confusing to me. Where the Green Fork runs, how there can only be one crossing of the twins, it's crazy, all this sort of stuff. But I'm sure it's all true and it's fine and we do know what happens. But at this point in the books, I don't think they talk about this in the show, but Jaime has Catelyn's brother hostage, Edmure Tully. So Jaime has won in the Riverlands to a certain degree and has Edmure hostage, and then Robb is about to turn the tables and take Jaime hostage. So, and that's impressive. That's a very impressive for Robb Stark, boy king, to defeat Jaime Lannister.
Right.
And that's coming up, but still, it's very impressive.
Yeah. So finally, last scene at King's Landing. Great scene here. Sansa's in the throne room, and when she's walking in, like, all these awful looks, right, that she gets.
Yeah.
Because she is now the daughter of a traitor. A few things happen. Cersei promises Janna Slynt lordship, right? I think it is.
In the books, yes. I wasn't... It was like background noise, right? Like Sansa's walking around in the background here, Janna Slynt getting his promotion, basically. But in the books, he was promised Harrenhal. We need to track how many people have been promised Harrenhal at one point or another. Harrenhal or the Eyrie or whatever. But yeah, he gets made Lord of Harrenhal and gets a seat on the Small Council.
So Ser Barristan gets the opposite.
This is the best.
He gets fired, right?
Yes.
And why do you think this is the best, Joanna?
Well, for a couple of reasons. My favorite part is the fact that Sansa's there for this because Sansa's so obsessed with knighthood and chivalry and honor. And Ser Barristan Selmy is like the knight's knight. Like he is the most famous living knight you know, the most honorable knight.
Right.
And for Cersei to treat him so shabbily, like, this has to be some scales falling from Sansa's eyes in this moment. And, you know, and then for Ser Barristan to basically, like, be like, you can't fire me, I quit.
like, well, he came dangerously close, I thought, to provoking some retaliation.
Because he drew his sword.
Yeah, he drew his sword and pointed it. You're like, that's just, ooh. Yeah. I was surprised he was allowed to walk out of there with his life, to be honest. So,
but then Littlefinger made that crack, and everyone laughed, and you know, and it was just. I think that it's more obvious in the book, like, how obsessed Sansa is with knighthood and chivalry, and so for her to see Ser Barristan humiliated that way, and to see, like, Joffrey and Cersei engineering his humiliation,
right? Joffrey saying, like, you couldn't even protect my dad from a boar. You're old. You can't save anyone. Right?
Joffrey's a real little dick in this scene. So,
but yeah, you also get a sense of, I think, in both the book and the show, that hey, the, like, knights take their vows for life. This is not just like some desk job you retire from. You know,
well, the Kingsguard specifically. Yeah.
Sorry, not knights. Kingsguard. Yes.
Your Grace.
The council has determined that Sir Jaime Lannister would take your place as Lord Commander of the King's Guard.
The man who profaned his blade with the blood of the king he had sworn to defend.
Careful, sir.
We have nothing but gratitude for your long service, good sir.
You shall be given a stout keep beside the sea with servants to look after your every need.
A hall to die in and men to bury me.
Yeah, and then in the book, they, like, try to make the Hound the head of the Kingsguard, and the Hound's like, I don't really want to be. And everyone's like, weirded out by it, because it's, like, the Hound is not even a knight, so it's just, yeah.
Yeah.
The Cersei and Joff are not off to a great start leading. I mean, basically, right, they promote Janna Slit and fire Barristan Selmy, like, okay, all right. This is the beginning of the end.
Why do you think they fired Barristan, by the way? Like, other than the fact that Joffrey thinks he's useless, or was that it? Like, I thought it was just because they might be unsure of... Because I thought basically it's because Barristan was a good guy. And they didn't know if you'd do honorable things when they needed people who wouldn't do honorable things.
They wanted people they could buy, like Janice. Right. And then Barristan kind of supported Ned. Like, he didn't go so far as to draw his sword in order to support Ned. But he was kind of on Ned's side in the throne room when Ned was making his stand.
Right. When he's like, those are the king's words.
Yeah, exactly.
You're ripping up.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
And so Cersei's like, great, I can't manipulate you, so I can't use you.
Right.
And I need you gone, basically. Yeah.
Then Sansa goes to beg for mercy.
Yeah.
And I think they basically say, look, if you can get your dad to acknowledge that he did a bad thing, we'll let you all go. Right. Or no, they'll show mercy, I think is what they say.
Yeah.
So, and then one of my favorite shots from the entire series, Jenna Robinson, which is that final shot where the camera tilts, the image of Sansa is subsumed by the shadow throne. Of the throne.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Kind of a very great symbolic camera movement of what is actually going on in that scene.
So, with the swords.
Little, like, kind of pointy things sticking out of the throne, yeah.
The pointy end?
The pointy ends. Come back around. So, overall, what do you think of this episode, Jonna?
It's a good episode. We noticed this when laying out the show notes that it's an episode that takes place in a lot of different place locations. It's sort of scattered, and I think you feel that a little bit. But it's also nice to see some great character work on Rob. And, I mean, establishment of the zombies as a threat in the north. You know, like, this is the first the Night's Watch is going to, like, take the supernatural seriously, right?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, a good episode, a sad episode. Maybe not one of the best in season one, but a good episode.
Yeah, solid episode, great moments. And certainly an episode that is very well paid off in the next episode.
Dun, dun, dun.
When we'll see what happens. At this point in time, I still remember thinking, though, there's still a lot of hope in this situation, right? Like, Rob might win. They might get Ned back. Joffrey might actually show mercy. All this stuff going on that might end up being a more conventional story. So
something that I love about, I mean, we'll talk about this at great length next week, but it's just like Cersei would have shown mercy.
Right.
She would have sent him to the Night's Watch or something. And
There's this whole sort of plot, or not plot, but like John thinks like, what would happen? Would they send Ned to the Night's Watch? Like, that would be so humiliating for Ned to have to take the black. Like, John goes through this whole kind of daydream about it, right?
Yeah.
That would be interesting. But what would have happened? Firstly, strategically, it would have made sense for Tywin has said, like, or thought, you know, it doesn't make sense to kill Ned. There's no reason to kill Ned, right?
Yeah.
It just does no one any good. So, you know, it certainly means, like, Cersei's kind of losing control of what's going on if Ned were to die, you know,
like,
what I mean?
Cersei makes some bad decisions, but even she would not have killed Ned Stark on the steps of the Sept of Baelor. Like, right. That was a dumb Joffrey move, and everyone suffers as a result.
There is a moment in the book. The book ends with this. One of the chapters ends with this like ominous line of, "Oh, after Sansa finished talking with Cersei, she realized that they hadn't even mentioned Arya."
Yeah.
What did you think of that?
That she forgot to ask about her sister. I mean, it's just they have this antagonistic relationship, and I don't think Sansa is yet at the point where she really values like her wolf pack, like that the Starks. You know, I think she's still at the point where she wants to become a Lannister, wants to become a Baratheon. Basically, that's right. Where she feels like she belongs. So, it's similar to, I mean, Sansa was the one who like kind of treated Jon like he was a bastard, which he was, but like she's the only Stark kid who treated him that way. You know, so Sansa was like kind of a bit of an asshole to her family, and I think that's just a long lesson that Sansa learns. That her people are the better people in the long run. So
right, or as I think it's Pycelle or Varys puts it, that blood is more powerful than oaths.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Well, I think Sansa is going to grow up real quick. The rest
real
of
fast.
The season.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. Well, stay tuned to hear what we'll be talking about next week. What chapter to read through? In the meantime, John Robinson, where can people find more of your work on the internet?
I'm on vacation right now, but when I get back, you can find me on vanityfair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. You can listen to me talk about television in general and the station agents. And I'm doing some special Star Wars episodes over on Fighting in the War Room in the next few weeks.
All right. Find my directorial debut at theprimaryinstinct.com, where you can buy the film I directed featuring Stephen Tobolowsky. Joanna, where are we reading to next week?
We're reading up through Arya chapter 5, which is page 728 in my book.
Arya chapter 5, page 728. We got 2 weeks to go, I think, right? This is episode 8, and then we got 9 and 10 left, and that's it. So we are nearing the end of season 1. We hope you guys have been enjoying this, and we'll see you guys next week.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of U.S. soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.